lot of our elders have empty freezers this winter. You know, and our children, that means too that our children are not being raised on our traditional foods.
Atna Incorporated wants to transform how game is managed on tribal land. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, VPSOs talk about the possibility of carrying firearms.
In the back of your head, you think, if you carry a firearm, how is this person going to react?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Alaska tribes and rural hunters have long complained that the dual federal-state game management system is hard to live by and doesn't give subsistence users their due. Today, Atna Incorporated, the smallest of Alaska's regional native corporations, presented a proposal for co-management of game to a U.S. House panel. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, it's a pilot project and it's sure to be controversial.
Unlike most of rural Alaska, the eight villages of the Atna region are on the road system. Atna President Michelle Anderson told a congressional panel today that every season, local hunters have to contend with more hunters who drive in from elsewhere.
It's a shame that this last season, for instance, you know, many of our hunters who have always gotten a moose couldn't compete with everyone else. A lot of our elders have empty freezers this winter. You know, and our children, that means too that our children are not being raised on our traditional foods.
Questions about how to divvy fish and game to favor subsistence users have plagued the state since the 1970s. Anderson says Atna has spent millions to protect their members' hunting rights and to control trespass on corporate lands. They say they need co-management, a real seat at the table with state and federal managers.
To be honest, we would be taken more seriously. You know, right now, we're just a voice complaining about these people that are coming onto our lands.
The proposal would authorize Atna and area tribes to jointly manage wildlife on Native Corporation lands. It would also establish co-management on what Atna says is its traditional hunting grounds. That territory includes state and federal land stretching from Cantwell to beyond McCarthy. Tara Sweeney of Alaska Federation of Natives testified the proposal will help preserve the subsistence rights of non-natives living in rural Alaska, too. Sweeney acknowledges not everyone will see it that way.
The issue of food security for Alaska Natives has always been a controversial issue, and we're here to stand behind the people of the Atna region. It's going to impact a very small portion of the state.
She and Anderson were the only witnesses at the Indian Affairs Subcommittee today. The head of the Alaska State Office in Washington, Kip Knutson, says the state will submit a response. By his initial reading of the draft bill, the state would have the option to participate or not. But Knutson says the proposal is very complex.
The bill is covering issues that have been fought about and debated in Alaska for 40 years. So we'll have to cover quite a bit of ground in our comments, I suspect.
The subcommittee chairman, Alaska Congressman Don Young, said at the end of the hearing he intends to pursue this, and he sees rough waters ahead.
Thank you, and I will tell you this is something I believe in, or I wouldn't do it, and it's just great jeopardy I do this. But if I don't do it, why am I here?
Young says he's listening to all sides and aims to leave a legacy of increased opportunities for subsistence, as well as sport hunting and participation in what he called the Great Alaska Experience. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The effort to allow VPSOs to carry guns cleared a major hurdle this week when the Alaska House unanimously passed the bill that does just that. The decision is now in the hands of legislators in Juneau, and while the bill passed 38 to zero. The issue on the ground is more nuanced. Several YK Delta VPSOs were in Bethel for training last week and spoke to KYUK's Ben Matheson about the prospect of being armed.
Jacob Tabithluk is from Nunapachuk and is an 8-year veteran of the VPSOs. He said he initially had mixed feelings about arming VPSOs, and that's because many of the people he meets in his job are people he's known for years.
In the back of your head, you think, if you carry a firearm, how is this person going to react, or how is this person that you've dealt with for so long? Being unarmed and going to a call where there's guns involved, having someone else point a firearm at you, it lack of better words, it freaks you out to where you realize how quick things can go bad.
Sergeant Jonathan Otto has been a VPSO in Congigaguk for 20 years. He says conversations with community members have been largely in favor of arming, and that's critical because communities will have some say in whether their VPSO is armed.
I've been told by some people that it's about time you guys are getting armed because of how the young people are getting more aggressive, that we should be able to go home to our own families instead of just being killed.
Two officers have been killed in the line of duty, the most recent being Manicotic's Thomas Madole. That's what spurred the most recent legislative push. And in that law is the requirement for training standards. Otto says part of that training came very early for most VPSOs.
Most of the people in the rural villages have been taught to hunt with a long rifle. So, and most of them have been told about not pointing a gun to anybody. We've been told since we were kids, when our dads taught us how to use a gun.
Tabithluk says it's ultimately a matter of officer safety. He says guns are part of the lifestyle in his community. Having a VPSO armed just makes sense.
I don't care if it's a shack. You're going to find some kind of gun. And you'll see kids walking around holding guns, going out hunting. And it's a common thing in the villages. And for a VPSO to carry a sidearm, I don't think there's anything, it would be anything new. A trooper comes out with a sidearm, a kid walks up to him and looks at his sidearm and walks away. It's going to be nothing new.
The bill to allow VPSOs to be armed is now in the Alaska Senate. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The Alaska Senate Education Committee moved Governor Sean Parnell's omnibus education bill today after rejecting amendments offered by the committee's lone Democrat. Senator Berta Gardner, a Democrat from Anchorage, offered an amendment to raise the per pupil allocation rate by $404 in the first year and tie it to the inflation rate for the following years. All three amendments failed by a 4-1 vote along party lines. Gardner raised objections over the bill, saying it does not improve the quality of preschool programs nor support highly effective teachers. The bill moves to the Senate Finance Committee next. The legislature has rejected proposed pay increases for the governor, lieutenant governor, and Maine department heads. The House voted 38-0 today to reject the recommendations of the State Officers' Compensation Commission. SB 125 passed the Senate 19-0 last month. The commission proposed the increases as a way for those positions to catch up with pay increases for other executive branch employees. But some legislators said, in light of budget constraints, the increases were not appropriate. Governor Sean Parnell had already said he would decline a pay raise for himself. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a small high school project in Sitka makes a big impact at the community gym.
He's done a phenomenal miracle. As I watch the basket lifting up to the ceiling with ease,
that's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Southeast Alaska divers were out fishing for geoducks yesterday for the first time in about 2 months. Processors found a market for the clams outside of China, which still has not lifted its ban on West Coast shellfish. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
Phil Doherty of the Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fishery Association says they decided to move forward with fishing after meeting last week with some processors. He says those processors found markets other than China for the clams.
We did our PSP sampling on Sunday. We sent the geoducks up to the Department of Environmental Conservation's lab in Anchorage on Monday. We got the PSP results on Tuesday. And of the six areas that we sampled, three of them passed PSP levels, and so we were able to fish.
PSP, or paralytic shellfish poisoning, is caused by eating shellfish contaminated with certain kinds of algae that produce toxins. It can be deadly, so all commercially harvested shellfish is tested before it can be sold. SARDFA suspended testing and therefore fishing soon after China banned imports of West Coast shellfish in December. Chinese officials claimed they found high toxin and arsenic levels in geoducks from Washington State and from dive areas around Ketchikan, but West Coast officials say they've not been given any details or proof from China. That's led to questions about whether the ban is politically motivated. Officials from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration had planned a March 3rd diplomatic trip to China with the goal of solving or at least obtaining more information about that country's ban on West Coast shellfish, but that trip didn't happen. With a little pressure from Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, though, NOAA agreed to reschedule the trip and is sending a delegation to China on March 21st. During a Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee meeting with Food and Drug Administrator Margaret Hamburg, Murkowski stressed the importance of resolving the issue and asked that the FDA get involved.
This is an issue that might be very narrow in its scope, but has great impact in, and certainly a portion of my state, impacting some basically family-owned businesses that are really taking a real hit right now.
Hamburg responded that her office has been providing information and support to NOAA and to Chinese officials.
We are not going to be formally part of the delegation, but we'll be in contact with them. We'll be working with them and supporting them. And we also do have an office in China to provide additional support.
Doherty says he and state officials will participate in a teleconference with NOAA and Washington state officials and fishermen before the China trip to provide any information that the delegation needs. He hopes another teleconference will take place soon after that trip. The outcome could determine when and how much divers fish in the near future. China is the largest market for geoduck clams, but not the only one.
There are markets over in Vietnam and Hong Kong and Malaysia, and there are some markets in the United States that these geoducks go to. So I think our processors have done a good job of trying to put something together so the fishermen can go out and earn at least a little bit of money here.
It could be too little, though. Doherty says the price paid in smaller markets might not make the work worthwhile. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
The Juneau School Board will not reconsider the ban on middle school sports travel, at least for the rest of the school year. A community task force and overwhelming public testimony to reconsider the ban did little to sway the elected body. That means starting next fall, Juneau's two middle schools will not be able to travel to other communities around the state to compete in sports. KTOO's Lisa Fu reports.
Floyd Dryden Middle School teacher Jeanette Sleppy is a member of the community task force created to come up with alternatives to the travel ban. Sleppy was one of several who spoke out in unanimous opposition of the ban during Tuesday night's Board of Education meeting at Juneau Douglas High School.
Our superintendent was quoted recently stating, "Building trust comes down to doing what the community is asking you to do through the elected board and following through with that. I urge you, the board, to build trust with us, this community, and continue to allow our middle school student athletes the opportunities that competitive travel offers and has offered the middle school students of this community for many years.
The school board adopted the travel ban last September. It takes effect in July. Sleppy said the task force conducted an online survey and received 263 responses. Of those, she said, only 9% support the ban on middle school sports travel. In its final report, the task force recommends permitting out-of-town travel under certain conditions. These include making travel available to all team members and limiting each team to only one trip per school year. Tom Rotecki is a member of the school district's Activities Advisory Committee. He says the group did not put forward a recommendation to the task force.
But we do agree that travel should be allowed for middle school activities and athletics.
Rotecki says before any policy on travel is developed, the board needs to establish a philosophy on middle school sports. He says the Activities Advisory Committee has started working on one.
We basically are trying to get away from a competitive philosophy of teams that win to a developmental approach. We want to recommend establishing grade level teams, you know, go away from the skill based teams and divide them into teams where fundamental social and physical skills are developed.
Following public testimony in favor of permitting middle school travel and the presentation by the task force, school board president Sally Sadler asked the body if they wanted to reconsider the ban.
Can I get a show of hands of board members who want to see this on the agenda next month?
When no hands went up, the packed audience broke out in a murmur. School board member Barbara Thurston said the task force's recommendations didn't bring the board any closer to resolving the issues, and the board wasn't ready to reconsider the ban.
The conclusion I get from this is that the ideal situation at the middle schools is that it involves both an intramural and a competitive component. And we have one school that has a competitive program, but not an intramural program, and one that has intramurals and not competitive. And if the proposal and the resources allowed for both at both schools, I think that's where we could go. But it really sounds like we have to choose, that neither school can afford to do both.
Juneau resident John Kurland led the task force. He said the school board's reaction is disappointing.
I feel bad for Juneau kids who are in elementary school or in middle school who aren't going to have those opportunities in the future.
While Kurland didn't get the outcome he was hoping for, he says the group will likely not pursue the issue.
I don't think so. I think this committee has done its work.
Sadler said the school board will not look into the middle school travel ban again this school year unless the Activities Advisory Committee comes forward with a philosophy. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ed Schoenfeld. This week on AK, Machine Shop. Manufacturing, like everything else, is becoming more computerized. But instead of replacing craftsmanship, digital technology is opening up possibilities. Students can create things in ways that simply weren't practical a decade ago. Three kids at Sitka High School are building a tool. Really, just a customized piece of metal to do an unsung but important job in the community. And as KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports, their collaboration points toward a future where we'll make stuff differently.
This is a story about hardware, but on the outside chance you're not into hardware, there is also some impressive footwork.
Where are we at?
We're at an inch and 15 thousandths. I just need to cut
15,000ths, and we'll flip it over and work on the other side.
This is Mark Partito, a junior in the school's metal shop. The room is dim and cavernous. Kids are welding and grinding metal. There is a constant racket. In the middle of it all, Partito stands balanced on his right foot and slides his left foot out of his sneaker and lifts it to his waist to operate the levers and control handles of a huge metal lathe with his toes. I wasn't expecting to meet Mark. Someday, someone will do a story just about him and the birth defect, arthrogryposis, that has severely limited his use of his lower arms and hands. All I can think of is possibly the dumbest question ever asked.
Tell me about running this machine with your feet. Was that a challenge?
A little bit, but this is like one of my favorite machines to work on. Some of the knobs are a little tough, but get used to it.
Mark is shaping a small cylinder of metal into what will eventually become a drill bit, but it's not for drilling holes. The bit will power a winch to raise and lower the baskets at Sitka's community gym. The original part has been lost for years.
My name's Robert Miller. I'm a senior.
Robert Miller goes by RJ. He made the part Mark is machining by casting molten aluminum in this kiln in a corner of the shop.
We're just trying a bunch of different methods and making a bunch of different types of them out of a bunch of different materials. I did aluminum casting with this yesterday. Today I think we're going to do brass. There was steel that has been done on it. None of them are finished yet.
Mark and RJ are experimenting with different metals, but that is as far as the guesswork goes. They also don't have blueprints. Instead, the pair are meticulously copying a red plastic prototype made across the hall on a $13,000 machine called a 3D printer. If the metal shop is the brawn, the hands and feet of this project, the brain is Sitka's state-of-the-art design and fabrication lab. Senior Thor Becker shows me how it works.
It's got to be three-dimensional because what it does, it's a nozzle that melted plastic comes out of and it goes layer by layer. So this is actually just, it prints one layer, and then it starts slowly building up and it has support material underneath it that the bigger one dissolves away and this one, the smaller one, just rips away.
The 3D printer is about the size of a mini fridge. Most of the design work in Sitka's wood and metal shops starts here among the rows of computer screens. Raising the baskets is important if you want to do anything else in a gym besides play basketball, like volleyball, for example. But for Sitka's nonprofit Hames Center, the $800 replacement part was just too expensive. Thor offered to help.
I took a small bit of just regular ceramics clay down there and kind of wedged it into the hole to get an impression of where what was in there, like what devices need to be turned and moved to spin the device.
He then measured his clay mold, drew the part on the computer, and then clicked on the print button. Thor and RJ and Mark have been fine-tuning the part ever since. Only one thing left to do.
Hopefully by the end of the day, I think the metal shop should have the drill bit laid out and looking nice and ready to go, and then can drive on down there and see if it will work.
And it really works.
My name is Cindy Edwards, and I'm the director of the Hames Center. I'm watching this incredible kid. He's a master, and he's done a phenomenal miracle. As I watch the basket lifting up to the ceiling with ease as he just runs that drill, this is amazing. Wow.
This used to take four people working in 15-minute shifts about an hour.
But it's a gym. It's not supposed to be easy.
Yeah, but this one has been so tedious that people fall, melt down, crying. And he's just hitting a button.
Thor poses for a picture with Edwards, but he's not ready to officially present her with the bit. He's going to go back to the fab lab and print another prototype that he thinks will work even better. For AK in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Now, it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're headed to Huna, a small community on Chichagof Island in Southeast.
My name is Chris Erickson. I live in Huna, Alaska. I run a guiding and outfitting business during the spring and the fall seasons for brown bear and black bear. And then during the summer season, I'm a charter captain on my 45-foot boat, the Icy Lady. To access Huna, The most common method is to fly into Juneau and then either come over on the ferry or take one of the small airlines, about a 20-minute flight over here or a three-hour ride on the Alaska Marine Highways. Huna, we're on the northern end of Chichagof Island, about 40 miles west of Juneau. Just a beautiful little community right at the mouth of Port Frederick. We're kind of uniquely situated in that we're an easily accessible community from the main road system or the main towns. We have very good fishing and deer hunting and, of course, lots of bears. Anywhere in southeast Alaska, you're going to have lots of bears. We're very close to Glacier Bay. It's about an hour and a half, two-hour trip by boat from Huna to the entrance to Glacier Bay to Bartlett Cove. And, of course, you can also fly with the smaller airlines that offer daily flights into there as well. About the last 10 years, the cruise ships have established a presence here through the Icy Strait Point, and so there's a bit of tourism going on, but by far I would say commercial fishing is probably our largest private employer. If you're looking for nightlife, Huna is not the place to go. Most people that live in Huna or come to Huna come here because we do have a very good fresh and saltwater fishing, outdoor opportunities, kayaking, climbing, hiking, and of course hunting, deer hunting, bear hunting, that sort of thing. Those people that live here because that rural lifestyle is what they prefer. We don't have all the social activities of the malls and the shopping and all those conveniences that come with it. So for a lot of people, it is difficult. But those of us who that's not the sort of things that we cater to, this is the place to be.
Chris Erickson runs a guiding business in Huna. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Robert Woolsey, Jolene Almendarez, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Bethel, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message is sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.